Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's warning at the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall that the world is on the brink of a new Cold War and trust should be restored by dialogue with Russia. Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of another Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, joins us to discuss her article at Reuters, Building Berlin's Wall Helped Avoid a Nuclear War, and her conversations with Gorbachev about the Berlin Wall and how, in Putin's Russia today, Gorbachev is seen by many as an American spy, while Putin accuses her grandfather of robbing Russia by handing Crimea over to Ukraine in 1954. Then we'll examine the secret mission by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who was able to obtain the release of two Americans, Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller, from captivity in North Korea and return with them on his plane to their families in the United States. A former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, joins us to discuss reports that one of the released prisoners planned to document brutal conditions inside the North's extensive prison camp system, and Ambassador Gregg's exchanges with a top North Korean diplomat, Jang Il-hun, prior to the release that indicated the North Koreans were very concerned that the United Nations report on human rights violations could lead to an indictment of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, before the International Court of Justice. Then finally, we'll look into the hollowing out of the Democratic Party in Congress from two losses in a row in the midterm elections and speak with John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation. He joins us to discuss the brain-dead nature of the Democratic campaigns in which candidates ran away from Obama and health care reform, while the president himself did nothing to refute his critics, refusing to use his considerable communication skills to extol his achievements and outline his vision for making life better for most Americans as the Republicans sabotage efforts to improve the economy for the 99% while backing policies that favor their backers, the 1%. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Reuters, Building Berlin's Wall Helped Avoid a Nuclear Confrontation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And in terms of just starting with the statement by Mikhail Gorbachev at the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down, he's quoted as saying, "The world is on the brink of a new Cold War. Some are even saying that it's already begun." How did that strike you?
Well, he's correct in the sense that the relationship really has been very frozen really in the negative value for a year now. I mean, of course, they've been not great before, but for a year since the Ukrainian crisis started unfolding last November, it has gotten worse and worse. So in this sense, Mikhail Gorbachev was right. On the other hand, if we do have problematic relationship, that is, Russia and the United States have problematic relationship, I think we should come up with a better name for it, because Cold War had its specific characteristics, and we are not having those characteristics today, although there is a certain amount of animosity, so maybe we can call it a frozen peace or something.
And of course, this is happening at a time when Russia and China are showing signs of getting closer, at least in terms of economic ties, ahead of the APEC summit starting in Beijing on Monday. And of course, following that, there'll be a G20 meeting in Brisbane, Australia, where the Australian Prime Minister had already said that when Mr. Putin shows up, he's going to you probably don't know this, Nina, because it's an Australian thing. He said, "I'm going to shirt front Mr. Putin," which is a term in Australian football for smashing your chest into somebody, you know. So that promises to be an interesting exchange. But how much, though, is the deterioration of the relationships between the U.S. and Russia? Obviously, a lot of people cite the eastward expansion of NATO as an unnecessary provocation, but it would seem to me that so much of this has to do with Putin himself. And that's pretty much what you argue in your article about the building of the Berlin Wall.
Well, absolutely. It is a lot about Putin himself, because it is Putin's choice to decide that NATO is a threat to Russia, or he can ignore it. So he obviously uses the NATO expansion as a threat. And more than anything, I think in 2002, when the Baltic states, particularly the Baltic states, former Soviet republics, got into NATO, he really got it as an insult more than a fear. And of course, he is to preserve his power to really prove that Russia is resurging back to the status it was during the Cold War. He needs those confrontations, or he needs to manipulate those kind of problems or create problems in a relationship, because, of course, any strong state, or so he sees it, needs a good enemy. So he creates an enemy out of the West. In fact, and it was really interesting that a couple of weeks ago, he himself spoke during one of those many meetings he has, either with intelligentsia or historians or policy makers, and he did say that Washington does not present a threat to Russia. However, it becomes could present a threat. So he himself admits that it's no threat, but he needs it for his own, to create this new Cold War mentality, new frozen peace mentality.
Well, of course, at this moment, there's an escalation of shelling in Donetsk, in the eastern part of Ukraine. There's an enormous amount of military material crossing from Russia to the pro-Russian rebels who have declared autonomy with this bogus election that they had. And on the American side, it would seem, with John McCain as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, there will be calls to arm Ukraine. Wouldn't this suggest that the situation in Ukraine is going to be escalated on both sides?
Well, it appears that it might, because it did seem that it was sort of a frozen conflict for a little bit, or hot frozen conflict, because, of course, the military actions were still going on both sides, both Kiev, Ukrainian government, and the rebels. It does seem to be a bit of an escalation now, because Russia supported those elections in East Ukraine, so they seem to agree that this is some sort of an independent republic. And we'll see. We still don't know what kind of actions Putin will take. Will he, then, would it be an Abkhaz scenario, as you remember in 2008 when Russia had a brief war with Georgia? The two republics within Georgia were flooded with the Russian passports, and then Russia took them over and made them independent or part of Russia, even if not entirely officially. But use that as an opportunity to take those republics from Georgia, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia. So the same could happen now. They would be flooding East Ukraine with Russian passports and then take those territories over. But I think we probably should be very careful predicting how exactly that is going to play out. But it is going to be a huge problem for the Kiev government, that's for sure.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also the editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Reuters, Building Berlin's Wall Helped Avoid a Nuclear Confrontation. Turning to your Reuters article, and of course it was your great-grandfather, although technically he was your grandfather, since your real grandfather died in the war. He, of course, built the wall, or it was built under his watch, and it came down under Gorbachev's watch. And Gorbachev reacted very differently. And he said that in conversations with you, apparently, that his reactions to the fall of the Berlin Wall were in many ways informed by your grandfather, who Gorbachev saw as a great reformer.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Gorbachev wrote about that, too, but from when, you know, when Gorbachev talks to you personally, that is a very stunning encounter, at least that they've been for me when I did talk to him. And he did say that he was called by various communist leaders from Eastern Europe, and he particularly mentioned Nicolae Ceaușescu of Romania, who called him and kept saying, we need to save Poland, because Poland was the most was the most dissident of all the socialist countries at the time. So we need to save Poland, we need to save the communist movement, we need to send tanks. And he said, I did not want to send tanks because we couldn't dictate the fates of the world if the world didn't want to be with us. And he did mention that when Nikita Khrushchev always fell under the pressure of East European leaders. I mean, Walter Ulbricht of East Berlin, of East Germany, was pushing him because people were, before the war, people were defecting from East Berlin to West Berlin. I think it was about 4 million people left by 1961. So Walter Ulbricht begged Khrushchev to help him with stopping this kind of flood of those defectors. Another thing Gorbachev remembered is Khrushchev sending tanks in 1956 to Budapest to stop collapse of the communist movement there, 68 in Prague. And so Gorbachev really didn't want to be that kind of Soviet leader. He wanted to be a democratic, he wanted to be a humanitarian leader.
Well, of course, what you point out in the article, the difference between the cynical use of anti-Western rhetoric and the current czar, if you will, Vladimir Putin, who does seem to have absolute power. I think so much of what's happening in Russia is to do with him more than anything. At least he's been able to affect the direction of Russia in a profound way. He, of course, says that he was lied to by the West, but in your grandfather's case, he really was, and that's clearly used to the point now where the Russian people feel that almost back to the kind of Cold War mentality that the West is out to get them. At least that's the propaganda machine that's underway. But contrast that with your grandfather. Dwight D. Eisenhower did, in fact, lie to your grandfather about the U-2 incident before the entire world. And he was, of course, caught in that lie. So it's pretty disingenuous of Putin to try and revive, if indeed that's his motive, to revive Cold War rhetoric. As many people suggest, the reason he's creating these crises and drumming up all of this anti-Western rhetoric is to simply distract the Russian people from the fact that he and the Siloviki around him are stealing the country blind.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's an empty entity in some ways. I mean, but he's a very brilliant empty entity. He chooses the weaknesses of others. He uses those. He knows how to keep the country under control by manipulating the psychology. And Russia has always been apprehensive about its very large size being in Eurasia, whether we are the East, whether we are the West. As for Khrushchev, I mean, I'm not. I don't mean to whitewash anything that was done during the Cold War. And in fact, I actually thought that it was a wrong title for the article, because my argument that it may have saved from nuclear confrontation, it wasn't. I was not certain about this, because it's really doesn't have entirely proof for that. But there was a real ideology. I mean, there was an ideology of competition between communism and capitalism, and they were real instances of ideological confrontation, military confrontation, lying. Both sides were lying to each other. And so in some ways, that was the Cold War. There was the differences of opinion of how to approach humanity. And the Soviet Union lost. And now Putin fakely trying to reengage in this competition, but really there is nothing behind it, because there is no ideology of confrontation altogether. So what does it mean the West is out to get us. To get us in what? To deliver 10 choices of cheese and good cars? Or what was the confrontation today? So in some ways, it is a very. That's why I'm so against the Cold War analogy, because Cold War was a real thing. Whatever Putin is doing today, Putin is not a real thing. We just forced to be living in that very unreal reality of Kremlin overwhelming control over Russia and Russians.
But in terms of the notion that your grandfather building the Berlin Wall, helped avoid a nuclear confrontation, which clearly is not the title he wanted. But still, I remember in conversations with Henry Kissinger about the central paradox of the Cold War in Europe, and that was that NATO's security depended upon Warsaw Pact stability. And that seems to be the sort of the big lie about the entire Cold War in Europe.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there was. I mean, and we can talk about sort of Kissinger, of course, came later, but we can talk about the whole Kennedy, I'm the Berlin and 1963 wall. It did seem that both sides may have reluctantly agreed to the wall because it did seem to be a better choice, because both were mistrusting each other. Both felt that if Berlin remained intact, the whole Berlin as this city that was continued to be occupied territory or considered occupied territory still in 61. So if they did make those very firm divisions, then one side could have taken over another, and Berlin was very much in the part of their conversation. So I can imagine that stability of the Warsaw Pact was also a very important balance during the Cold War, because the whole point also was to keep the war cold rather than having a chance to turn it into something hotter.
Well, we know in retrospect what a house of cards the Warsaw Pact was. And had, for example, Poland fell apart during the Cold War, that would have been the most likely trigger of a nuclear confrontation. I mean, I think the record's pretty clear, isn't it, that the Soviet leaders must have been terrified from day one about eruptions within their own Warsaw Pact bloc, as opposed to being afraid of the Americans crossing into the Fulda Gap and invading the Warsaw Pact.
Well, I'm sure they were terrified of that, but as you absolutely correctly suggested, and that was one of the points of my article that I'm making, is that, for example, Khrushchev was so concerned about the possibility that there would be some damage to the world communist movement. So when all those communist leaders would come to him and say, well, we need, in 1956, we need tanks in Budapest, then we need the Berlin Wall and whatnot. Absolutely. I mean, they were more afraid to be destroyed from within than be invaded by the United States or the West or by NATO, period. But that's what makes Putin so even more disingenuous, because even if then before there was a more threat of the inside dissolution today, obviously the reason Putin takes Ukraine so seriously, because the threat comes from the Slavic brother. If Ukraine can turn towards the West, so can Russia, and so his life in the Kremlin is going to be very short-lived.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Reuters, Building Berlin's Wall Helped Avoid a Nuclear Confrontation. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the secret mission by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, to North Korea.
Gravity.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, the chairman of the board of the Career Society in New York City, a career CIA officer. He served as Vice President George Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. And in 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name. His latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you.
And there are reports now that this secret mission by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, to North Korea, where he returned with Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller, who were held captive in North Korea, they returned with him on the plane to their families in the United States, that some of the reasons behind the release, particularly of Matthew Miller, may have been the belief that Matthew Miller was trying to get into the North Korean prison camps to document the brutal conditions. Is there any truth to that? Or do you have any sense of whether that could have been a possible motive?
I think that the entire issue of the gulags and the prison camps is a matter of high sensitivity to the North Koreans. I say that because on the 20th of October, I introduced Ambassador Jang Il-hung of North Korea to the Council on Foreign Relations, where he spoke on the record about human rights in North Korea. He took a lot of flack from human rights activists there because he had been told what to say by Pyongyang, and he could not really answer their questions to their satisfaction. But it was very clear that a matter of great sensitivity to them was the possibility that the UN might take action to try to indict Kim Jong-un for crimes against humanity due to the conditions in the gulags. So I don't know anything about what the young man in North Korea was doing, but if they thought he was going to try and get into a camp, that would be a matter of great sensitivity to them.
And, of course, there was another U.S. prisoner released about three to six months ago. So tell me about, do you have any understanding of how the two countries communicate? Obviously, you've tried to do a lot personally to bridge the gap and to create some kind of back channels. How do they communicate?
Well, it's not very easy. I was at a conference in the UK at the University of UCLan, which is the University of Upper Lancashire, and there were a lot of people there from the EU, and the EU is an area which has formal diplomatic relations with North Korea. A number of the countries have first-class ambassadors there. For the United States, Sweden handles our interests, and it was very interesting to me that General Clapper's announcement of his trip gave credit to Ambassador Anderson, the Swedish ambassador who covers our interests in Pyongyang. I'm now chairman of the Pacific Century Institute, which is in Chatsworth, California, out near L.A., I've made six trips to North Korea, and in February, four of us, all representing PCI, went to North Korea and heard from them what their economic development plans are, and have heard from them that they needed help in developing these plans, so we've been trying to be helpful on that. And after the meeting on the 20th of October with Ambassador Jang, I took him to dinner and said, "You made it clear that the prisoners have nothing to do with the human rights issue in the North." I was glad to hear that. And I said, "This is absolutely the time to release those people." And so yesterday, when I heard they had been released, I sent him a note congratulating him, and he responded an hour later, said, "Thank you very much. We talked about that, and I tried to do what you suggested." So that's the kind of communication we have. It's offline. I have no feedback whatsoever from the Obama administration. I had none from the Bush administration. I've had no feedback from anybody in the White House since I started going to North Korea. But I think it's been worth doing. And PCI now, I think, is a fairly well-trusted entity by them. And I think they talk fairly freely to us.
So, Donald Gregg, I'm sure there are people in our audience who are wondering why a former CIA officer would feel compelled to feel that there's a need to communicate with North Korea and to get beyond the demonization, which seems to be very popular in all political and journalistic circles.
What a wonderful question. I love the fact you asked me that. And the answer is very simple. I'd rather talk to them than fight them. I was involved for 4 years in the war in Vietnam, which we never should have fought. And I've observed, what happens when we do demonize foreign leaders. It costs us. And we certainly have demonized Kim Jong-un, calling him into question from the moment he appeared. The North Koreans think very highly of him. When I last went there in February this year, Vice Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs said the sky's the limit under Kim Jong-un. They think very highly of him. And I think this decision to release the prisoners comes directly from Kim Jong-un. I think it's the kind of decision he's going to start making. He's going to be around for a long time. I think we need to help him understand us better, and I think we need to understand them better than we do. For more than a decade, I've called North Korea the longest-running failure in the history of American intelligence, and I feel that that applies to intelligence organizationally, and it also applies to us intellectually.
Well, it would seem to me, just based on what you just said, Donald Gregg, that much of what we do in terms of our foreign policy, whether it's George W. Bush or his successor, Barack Obama, we sort of follow this line, which goes back to George W. Bush's Axis of Evil speech, where if you put Iraq, Iran, and North Korea beyond the pale, then there you don't have recognition, you don't have embassies, you don't have people on the ground. All you have are the overhead national technical means to look at what's going on, which doesn't tell you very much. So I'm always puzzled as to why rhetorically we place people beyond the pale, which completely blinds us to what's really going on.
Well, that's an apt description of the process that takes place, and I've been particularly disappointed that Obama seems to have inherited some of the worst tendencies of the Bush administration in that reason. I hand-carried to the White House in 2002 a written offer from North Korea, from Kim Jong-il, to restart talks. And I was in and out of the White House in 20 minutes, and Condoleezza Rice's deputy said, oh, no, we won't talk to them. That would be rewarding bad behavior. And we have now something called strategic patience, which is essentially the same thing. We're sort of hoping that North Korea will implode, and they're not going to implode. And the longer we don't talk to them, the stronger their nuclear deterrent becomes. The North Koreans have made it very clear to me that they want to talk to us, but that until we sit down and really talk to them without a lot of preconditions, they're going to continue to strengthen their nuclear deterrent. And so I think the longer we wait to talk, the deeper the pit we're into that we'll have to eventually climb out of.
Well, we seem to be very concerned about Iran's possible or potential to build a nuclear weapon, even though they say they're not doing so. And one of the reasons, I think, is because if Iran does get a nuclear weapon, it's likely to invite an Israeli preemptive strike, and it's also likely to stimulate the Saudi Arabians to go nuclear. And doesn't the same apply to the Korean Peninsula? The more that North Korea gets nuclear weapons, the more pressure on the South to get nuclear weapons, and the more pressure on Japan to get nuclear weapons. So there's more at stake than just the actual country we're talking about, North Korea.
No, that's correct. I mean, fortunately, Israel is not involved in this, or the sensitivity would be much higher. And at least in the case of Iran, President Obama continues to write letters to Khamenei. And, he's dumped on for doing that. I'm very glad he does, because I think it's extremely important that we reach an agreement with Iran. I think North Korea is not a nuclear threat to anyone. I think they know that if they used a nuclear weapon, they would be obliterated. But as you say, if they get them, others will be tempted to, and there are right-wingers in South Korea who are already talking about developing nuclear weapons, something that I had a hand in stopping when I was chief of station there in the mid-70s.
So what then is the likelihood of following on from James Clapper's, the opening that clearly, and you suggested came, the decisions came from the North Korean leader to release the American prisoners. What do you think the next step could be or should be?
Well, I wish that it were more of an opening than it seems to be, because the White House has bent over backwards to say that he wasn't there to negotiate anything. I think he's a very intelligent, experienced intelligence officer. I think he picked up a lot of vibes from what he saw there. I think that's all to the best. All I'm in position to do is to suggest that we meet with Ambassador Jiang and discuss the possibility of a Council on Foreign Relations delegation going to North Korea, where we can talk about a whole panoply of issues, including perhaps even human rights. So that's what I'm able to at least talk about from my outside position. What the Obama White House is thinking about, I cannot fathom.
But in terms of North Korea's obvious concerns over the UN report on human rights violations, which as you suggested, the ambassador that you talked to, who recently replied to you saying that he'd taken your advice, the concern that Kim Jong-un could be indicted and you know, to basically, you know, held to he would never be extradited, but he could end up being indicted before the International Court of Justice. So What are the North Koreans going to do in terms of dodging that bullet?
Well, I would think that probably one of the things that went through their mind was, let's release these prisoners and that will take some of the heat off us. And I think that was probably, you know, a valid consideration on their part. But that's not a permanent solution. I think the permanent solution can only come where they recognize that they have a terrible problem in terms of the image that comes from running their gulags, and they've got to take that into account. And when people ask me why I keep fooling around with the North Koreans, I say not only I'd rather talk but fight. I said my experience is that totalitarian regimes, and North Korea is a totalitarian regime, they change only when they see that it is in their interest to change. That happened after Nixon reached out to China. And it also happened after George Herbert Walker Bush and Gorbachev worked together to bring down the Berlin Wall. And changes took place. And I think changes need to start to take place in North Korea, internally generated. And so I think these talks to the North Koreans about their human rights problem are very valuable if it translates into actions which they can take on their own volition within their society to make it less repressive.
And what are the, I mean, clearly the UN is headed by a South Korean. Is there anything to be, any association to be made there? The South Koreans paradoxically seem quite divided. In many ways, there are constituencies in South Korea that many argue are apologists for the North, but then there are other constituencies in and I believe clearly the new leader whose father was killed by North Korean agents, I think his mother, I can't remember, they attacked the
her
Blue
mother. House. Her mother
was killed, right, yeah.
And they tried to kill her father twice.
Right. So she's got to be a little leery of them. So is there anything at play there?
Yes, there is. I mean, I think the changes in or the division in views is somewhat age-based. Older people remember the horrors of the Korean War and are still very much fearful and negative about North Korea. Younger people are more flexible. But the Kim Park Geun-hye, I met her in 2002. She went once to North Korea. And I congratulated her for doing it, and she said to me, I'll never forget it, we must look to the future with hope, not to the past with bitterness. But unfortunately, her Nordpolitik policy really hasn't come to amount to much, but she still has over 2 years left in her presidency, and I hope she will do more. And if she did do more, that would makes it easier for the United States to rethink its strategic patients policy and start to open up.
And quite often, our analysts tell us that the key to solving the problem between on the Korean Peninsula lies with China. And I can't imagine that China would have any interest in the North collapsing. They wouldn't want the U.S. military back on the Yalu River, would they?
Absolutely right. I mean, the Chinese are much more concerned about political implosion or explosion, either one of which would trigger a mass exodus of North Koreans into China. So they are much less worried about a small nuclear capability, which they know the North Koreans will not use. I think China has played a useful role in putting a certain amount of pressure on North Korea, but we cannot expect China to do our work for us. The Chinese and the North Koreans have 1,000 years of hostility between them, and they don't like each other. And so at some point, the key to stability in that whole region is the reestablishment of a solid relationship between the United States and both halves of the Korean Peninsula.
Well, just in closing, Donald Gregg, the Berlin Wall, of course, came down 25 years ago, and there is an article in Sunday's New York Times suggesting that China and Putin are getting closer together. And you mentioned Nixon's opening to China, which effectively put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play China off against Russia. Have the Chinese reversed that, and now is President Xi in the catbird seat, being able to play Putin off against Obama?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell that, but I think it's very interesting that President Obama, who I think is a very astute judge of people, he's going to be seeing both of them up close and personal on this trip that he's just started in Asia. At the conference that I attended in the UK a couple of weeks ago, there were some very intelligent senior Russians with whom I talked, and I said, look, I fought you guys in CIA all through the Cold War, but I have huge amount of respect for Russia, and if this century is going to be any better than our last, we have to find ways to work together on certain issues. And they said, well, we would agree with that, but you've got a very difficult situation with Putin, who is totally in control and has reawakened in the minds of the Russians and the hearts their hope of sort of international clout and grandeur. And so we have a real problem coming there. And what role Xi is going to play will become clearer to us all, I think, after Obama sees him on this trip to Asia.
Well, Donald Gregg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for your good questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, who is the chairman of the board of the Korea Society in New York City, a career CIA officer. He served as Vice President George Bush's National Security Advisor and the United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the hollowing out of the Democratic Party in Congress from two losses in a row in the midterm elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he's the author, with Robert McChesney, of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracy. And their latest book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It is terrific to be with you again, Ian.
Well, John, likewise. And you know, I called, I spoke with Lisa Graves on Tuesday on Election Day because I figured it was going to be a bad day for progressives and for Democrats. And I thought, well, the only ray of hope I'm reading about in terms of polls is in Wisconsin, where Governor Scott Walker is facing a stiff challenge and may not win. And that hope turned out to be chimeric. So what happened in Wisconsin?
Well, to quote our good friend Paul Simon, I would not give you false hope. The truth of the matter is that on November 4th, there was very little hope anywhere. You know, every competitive contest in which there looked to be a possibility that the Democrat might win went to the Republican. And so it, you know, you can look at Wisconsin, and certainly we can go as deep into it as you want. But the reality is that if you look across the map of the United States and you look at all the marginal contests for governorships, for Senate seats, and then even burrowing down deeper, going into races for U.S. House seats, state legislative positions, and governorships, what you find is that the Republicans won the marginal contests. Now, how did they do that? Well, it's the same in Wisconsin as a lot of other places. Number one, they benefited from a significantly lower level of turnout than in a presidential race. So right off the bat, you have a depressed number of voters coming. That depressed number of voters tends to skew more conservative and, in the current cycles, more Republican. Secondly, and this is the more important and deeper part of it, there was a last-minute flow of immense amounts of money into the process. After mid-October, when the financial statements came in from all the different, not just campaigns, but also so-called independent groups, we saw a huge increase in spending, and that increase was very closely targeted to states where you had close contests. And I think that it's safe to say that in states across the country, that final push of money proved to be very, very useful. Campaigns need money at the close, not just for television ads, but for mobilization, for getting people to the polls. And so those are top-line explanations for why the polling data you saw didn't prove to be as hopeful as you might have liked. The deeper issue, of course, is that throughout the entire campaign, as tough a year as this was politically, and midterms are tougher for Democrats, the Democratic Party had no coherent message, no set themes. They did very, very little to make a case for their base to come to vote, and they got a result that reflected that.
Well, it's extraordinary how brain-dead the campaigns were on the part of the Democrats. And you mentioned, John Nichols, the turnout in the 2010 midterm where they got devastated, the Democrats, 91 million voted, and 130 million voted in the last two presidential campaigns. But in 2010, 91 million voted, and in 2014, last Tuesday, only 83 million voted. So clearly that had an effect. But
oh, yeah.
But
you cannot politically survive if the people that you bring to the polls in a presidential year who provide the cushion, the base for your victories, young people, people of color, particularly younger working women, and lots of other working class folks, if they don't come to the polls in a midterm, there's no way you're going to pull it off.
But in terms of the brain-dead nature of the Democratic campaigns, you know, I was astounded that the candidates ran away from Obama and health care reform. But the president himself did nothing to refute his critics, and he refused to use his considerable communication skills to extol his achievements and outline his vision for making life better for most Americans. And And after all, he's running against a Republican Party who have been flagrantly sabotaging his efforts to improve the economy for the 99%, while they back the policies that favor their backers, the 1%. And as you mentioned, the 1% poured in money after the October 15th FEC deadline, so that it didn't have to be recorded. It won't be announced till after the elections how much money they poured in at the last minute.
No, that's exactly right. And so, look, all of this could have been anticipated. It's not, you know, none of this is complex stuff. And so what we really do look at here is, I would suggest, malpractice on the part of the Democratic Party. Now, was it willful malpractice? No, I think they thought they were, as always, that they had some kind of strategy. And I think they counted on the fact that they were actually raising a reasonable amount of money, often from the same or similar sources to the funders of a lot of the Democratic or Republican campaigns. But at the end of the day, they didn't start the process or end it with a clear strategy, a set of ideas, a set of principles. And here's why that matters. If the president is not himself aggressively defending his agenda, and if Democrats are running away from him, avoiding him, then think of the issues that you put off table for discussion. Number one issue that goes off the table, expansion of health care. Number two issue that goes off the table, the slow but steady improvement of the economy. Number three issue that goes off the table, the potential for future stimulus, future investment in the economy. Number four issue that goes off the table, the genuine advances that you have seen from a president who's put two women on the U.S. Supreme Court, who has at least tried to defend reproductive rights, and who has frankly presided not always as a leader, but certainly as a supporter over dramatic improvements in the circumstance of the LGBT community. And so, you know, you had all sorts of stuff to work with there, but when you run away from the president, when you run away from, you know, any kind of strategy, you end up doing one thing, which is joining in a discussion defined by the other side. And in this case, the discussion defined by the other side said, look, you're not satisfied, you're not particularly happy, things aren't as good as you want them to be, and you should vote against the party that's in charge in Washington. And that was a very effective strategy. It did two things. Number one, it energized the base of voters who are angry at Washington, who are angry at Obama, who tend to be more conservative. And number two, it demobilized the base of voters who might be sympathetic, excited, supportive, not just of Obama. Maybe they're upset with Obama. Maybe they don't think he's done enough. But are excited by the idea of trying to do more, of trying to make access to health care easier, trying to maybe do more stimulus, trying to address long-term unemployment. It's a terrible, terrible dysfunctional strategy. And it's one the Democrats have fallen into cycle after cycle. I think they can win by simply saying they're not the Republicans. But in midterm elections, that doesn't work. And the final thing I would throw into the mix, Ian, and I think this is really important. The Democratic Party is not paying sufficient attention to rural and small-town America. In Obama's victories, particularly in the 2008 victory, Obama was able to actually hold his own in rural America. And that had dramatic impacts of bringing out voters in vast stretches of this country who also cast ballots in Senate races, in House races, in legislative races. As the Democratic Party has focused so much of its energy, so much of its mobilization on urban areas, to some extent suburban areas, it really has neglected rural America. And that can't function politically because at the end of the day, it's actually in rural America that a lot of populist appeals traditionally have worked very, very well. And to emphasize that point, just to close the circle, understand this. In states with vast rural stretches, South Dakota, Nebraska, Alaska, Arkansas, they all voted overwhelmingly for substantial minimum wage increases. So they actually voted for a progressive populist change on the ballot, actually implementing it, but then they voted for Republicans for governor and senator.
Well, in terms of the point that you just made, that the minimum wage raise initiative passed in South Dakota, Nebraska, Alaska, and Arkansas. In Arkansas, it was on the ballot, and yet the incumbent ran away from it. The senator, who was key to the Democrats holding on to the Senate prior, he ran away from it because he was advised by his handlers that that would tie him to Obama. And, of course, it passed handily, and he lost. And you can't help making a connection there. So what kind of advice do these candidates get, apart from the fact that the candidates themselves appear to be tone deaf or brain dead, to take the advice in the first place?
Well, you're absolutely right. That's the bottom line. There's a consultant class that is increasingly disconnected and delinked from the base of the Democratic Party and, frankly, the great mass of American voters. They live in Washington. They live in the D.C. suburbs. They make huge amounts of money by placing political ads, by developing structures for spending money. Well, the bottom line is this. That works really well on the Republican side, surprisingly well, because, you know, that money, especially in a campaign like this, can pay for a tremendous number of negative ads. Those negative ads demobilize people. They make people feel disgusted and upset and move a lot of people away from the process. But for the Democratic Party historically, its secret has been a deeper level of grassroots organization, particularly at the courthouse level in states like Arkansas. And you have to give something to that base. You have to feed that base, not money, but ideas and values and commitments and progressive populism. And so it is absolutely amazing to me. It's stunning to me that the state of Arkansas would come out and vote overwhelmingly, landslide majority, for increasing the minimum wage. And yet the Democratic nominee is saying, well, I don't want to do that at the federal level. And intriguingly enough, this is the hidden part of the deal, the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate endorsed the Arkansas minimum wage increase.
You mean the Tea Party guy, Cotton?
Yeah, he endorsed it.
God, I didn't know that.
So here you had a situation where the headline, now, admittedly, Pryor supported it too at the state level, but the headline in Arkansas, here's two headlines. Number one, Democrat opposes federal minimum wage increase. Number two, Republican supports state minimum wage increase.
Hmm.
At the end of the day, you muddy the water on your most vital issues.
Well, look what happened. But look what happened, John Nichols, in the key state of Kentucky, where the Democrats are hoping to unseat Mitch McConnell. Alison Grimes, the Democratic challenger, refused to say that she'd voted for Obama, and she refused to because it would tie her to Obama and Obamacare. And yet, Obamacare is incredibly popular in Kentucky to the extent that Mitch McConnell himself lied to the voters and said, "I'm going to get rid of Obamacare, but not here in Kentucky." I mean,
yeah. No. Look.
God help us.
Only George Orwell could possibly have seen you through this election and kept your head straight, right? Mm. I mean, you're dealing in Orwellian doublespeak at just about every level, and the absurdity of the thing is that we know there's only one way to get through that. If the other side is trying to muddy the waters, trying to soften its image, trying to make people think, frankly, that the election doesn't matter that much, the job of the Democrats in this cycle should have been to turn the volume up, to advocate more aggressively for a simple economic agenda that, by the way, polling shows Democrats, Republicans, and independents like. That's substantial increases in the minimum wage, expansion of paid sick leave, good expansions of health care, addressing challenges, et cetera. But here's one other thing about it, and this is a big problem for the Democratic Party. People really don't like the free trade agenda. They don't like things like the TPP and NAFTA, China free trade, a whole host of them from the past. And unfortunately, because President Obama is sympathetic with elements of that free trade agenda, you had a situation where instead of really turning the volume up on that, you had a lot of people dialing it down. This is a big problem because the fact is those are the kinds of issues. Protecting U.S. jobs, protecting retaining entire environmental protections, and frankly, you know, defending human rights in the U.S. and abroad. Those are the kinds of issues that can actually mobilize people. But you had the volume dialed down so low on that in some key states that even Democrats who are good on those issues got very little advantage from it.
Just in the last couple of minutes then, John Nichols, the president in his press conference after the drubbing mentioned the two-thirds that didn't vote. And if, in terms of the young and minorities, I mean, all you ever hear from the Democratic Party, this is everybody complains to me that all they ever get is solicitations for money. Kids don't have any money today. Students are got saddled with student debt before they even get a job. They're not going to give you any money, but they've got talent, they've got ideas. Why can't they mobilize the energy of the young people and join this empty shell of a party that clearly has no direction and is run by Jurassic, you know, political operatives?
Well, you said political operatives. Let me use a better word, fools. Mm-hmm. The people at the top of the Democratic Party do not know how to do things. Look, I'll give you a contrast. It's the simplest thing in the world. I was in Scotland for much of September watching the Scottish independence referendum, which didn't win but did incredibly well, surprised everybody by the level of support it got. You know, in Scotland, they had an 86% turnout. Everywhere I went, I met young people who were highly engaged. Why? Because something big was in play. If the Democratic Party doesn't put something big in play each election cycle, doesn't say we need to win because we want to do this next big thing, we want to make college education free of charge like it is in many other countries, or at such a low cost that, you know, everybody who's qualified for college can go without huge student debt. If you don't put big deal things, a national system of free daycare for all young moms and dads, you know, things like that, you're going to have a very hard time mobilizing people, because most people think that government doesn't get much done and it lives on autopilot. And so I can't emphasize, low expectations, low demands, low promises, low commitments from the Democratic Party is an invitation to sit the process out. And unfortunately for the Democrats, that's fine, because that actually is an invitation for a lot of the base of the Republican Party to come vote. And so you end up in a terrible situation where the Democratic Party actually becomes almost a facilitator of a lot of the Republican message.
Well,
and
John,
got to break out of that habit.
John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and is the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy, and their latest, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.